You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the world's focus may be on Libya, Egypt and Iran, but violence in Iraq remains worryingly high. Our man in Baghdad is back briefly in London and he joins us here in the studio. South Africa's striking miners may be heading back to work. Is the country's biggest crisis since the end of apartheid over? We'll be in Cape Town. It's Lusophone Week here on Monocle 24. We'll find out why Brazil's luxury retail sector is booming, and there might even be some Brazilian music too. And Istanbul has ambitious plans for a new stock exchange. How realistic are they? We'll be in Turkey for the answer. All that, plus another guest from the London Design Festival, all to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. NATO has ordered a cutback on operations with Afghan forces in response to a surge of so-called insider attacks on foreign servicemen. However, the peacekeeper's strategy in Afghanistan remains unchanged, according to its chief, Anish Fogh Rasmussen. Talking to correspondents in Brussels today, he said the measures taken to protect NATO troops in Afghanistan were wise for the time being.
We have said all along that we will take every step necessary to minimize the risks to our troops, and that's what we are doing. And let me be clear, we remain committed to our strategy. And we remain committed to our goal of seeing the Afghans fully in charge of their own security by the end of 2000.
In other developments, Afghan militants have claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb attack on a minibus carrying foreign workers that killed at least 12 people near Kabul. Afghan police said among the dead were 8 Russians and South Africans, mostly working for a foreign air charter company. The militants say it was in retaliation for the anti-Islamic film, which was made with private funds in the United States and has ignited several days of demonstrations in the Arab world, Africa, Asia, and in some Western countries. 2 unarmed policewomen have been killed in a shooting in the north of England. The attack in a district of Manchester likely to reignite a long-running debate in Britain over whether officers should carry guns. A man already wanted on suspicion of 2 murders, Dale Cregan, was later arrested in connection with the shooting after he walked into a police station. Prime Minister David Cameron called the incident shocking and expressed his condolences. Britain's cash-strapped government is considering further cuts to its welfare bill, with a coalition source confirming an idea to scrap the link between inflation and rises in benefits payments, which has been floated by ministers. The coalition government, struggling to deliver its austerity plan because of a return to recession, will spend £207 billion on social protection this year, nearly a third of all spending, and by far the biggest item on its budget. Greece will meet its nominal 2012 deficit reduction targets, but faces growing strain because of the deepening recession, according to Finance Minister Yiannis Tournadas. His announcement came as pressure grew on international creditors to give the Greek government more time to catch up. The expelled ANC Youth League leader Julius Malema has attacked South African President Jacob Zuma a day after police prevented him from addressing striking miners at Wondercop Stadium in Marikana. Malema said Zuma had militarized police, like all dictators, when he took office.
I've cautioned South Africa before that since Jacob Zuma took over leadership of South African state, we've seen introduction of dictatorship and extremely intolerant forms of leadership. Because of his inability to persuade and politically convince those that disagree with him, he has resorted to usage of force in his leadership style.
Malema has become Zuma's most strident critic and has urged strikers to make mines ungovernable. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James Luckhurst, thank you very much indeed. It is 20.05, just gone in Athens, 18.05 here in London, 13.05 in Washington, D.C. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
South Africa's worst crisis since the fall of the apartheid regime could finally be coming to an end. Striking miners at the Marikana platinum mine have been offered a 22% pay rise 1 month after the strike began. It is a dispute that has unaccountably cost the lives of 45 people. In the worst violence, 34 miners were killed in one day by police officers, sparking a political crisis that President Jacob Zuma has failed to contain and that the populist Julius Malema has done his best to exploit. Our Cape Town correspondent Alex Duval-Smith has been following this story since day one, and she joins us on the line from South Africa now. Alex, welcome to Midori House. Can you just bring us up to date as to what's been going on over the past hour or so with this deal?
Thank you, Steve. Yes, well, Marikana's striking miners, 3,000 hardliners gathered on a sports field at the mine, greeted an offer of 22% pay rise with cheers. Previously, they'd been offered 1,500 rands, which is about 150 euros, as a one-off payment in return for going back to work and then negotiating. They rejected that, settling for nothing less than an overall 22% pay rise. Now, 22% sounds like quite a lot, but the hardliners in the strike had been demanding 12,500 rands, which is about 1,200 euros, which for some was a threefold pay increase. So for those who are on, say, 400 to 500 euros a month, this is not going to be such a huge pay rise. But things have changed somewhat politically in the last few days, and I think essentially the miners have felt themselves increasingly isolated in this strike, and the very tough stance adopted by the government has actually paid off for the employees and the government.
And talk us through what's likely to happen next. I mean, is it as simple as, you know, a pay rise is accepted by the leadership and everyone goes back to work, or is it a bit more complicated than that?
Well, it's complicated because it has now stretched beyond Marikana. So we've had a number of wildcat strikes in other platinum mines, most of which actually today were functioning again. But some of the gold producers have also felt strike action. So it's not clear what's going to happen on the gold mines. In terms of platinum, I think there's quite a strong likelihood of everyone going back to work. I don't have full details of the deal. It's only come through in the last hour. So I don't know if the 22% are tied to any further negotiations. There are lots of issues on the table, such as housing, such as the continued presence of squatter camps, shacks around platinum mines, which is something you don't see around other mines. Lots of living condition issues, working condition issues. I mean, just to give you an idea, the most militant miners at Marikana, the rock drillers, they weren't obliged to wear earmuffs until 2008, and they sit pounding the walls with 25-kilo hammer drills day in, day out. So, you know, lots to address. At the moment, what we know is 22%. Everyone goes back to work on Thursday.
Now, this dispute has helped to highlight a number of problems within the new South Africa that had been sort of boiling under, if you can describe it as that, for a number of years, occasionally exploding into the headlines. Like, for example, the still very high rates of poverty, like, for example, the still very high rates of unemployment, officially 25%, and the fact that although you know, the end of apartheid had obviously been good for economically for many people within South Africa, a lot of poorer black people are still don't have many opportunities. How have the different political elements, both inside the ANC and outside, tried to capitalise on this dispute?
Well, I mean, as we heard in the news headlines earlier, Julius Malema has very much capitalised on this situation. Julius Malema, being the leader of the ANC Youth League, very much has the ear of the majority of the population, even if many people look on his own somewhat lavish lifestyle with a little bit of suspicion. He still speaks the mind of millions of South Africans who believe that really economically, for the majority, things have not improved sufficiently. Housing has been provided, but it's of poor quality. Jobs have not been provided. The government has treated the mining industry a bit like a sort of a nasty smell, a problem area during apartheid, which hasn't been modernized and brought up to date in a way that could have made it really boom during the commodities boom. Now, those times are past because the recession started in 2008, and now, if anything, the mines are laying off workers again. So essentially, you have an economic sector which has been more or less at a standstill for the last 18 years, and an increasing amount of discontent on the ground, which Julius Malema absolutely knows how to pick up on. It's just that his own sort of slightly tarnished image does not make of him a great leader for the majority of people.
Well, quite. On that point with Julius Malema, I mean, he was, as the former president of the ANC Youth League, he was a very bombastic, very populist figure. As you say, he was, he had a very lavish lifestyle, which was at odds, at very least, with the salary he officially earned. And yet, during this dispute, and now he's been thrown out of the ANC, he's tried to portray himself as a sort of a leader of the poor. Has he managed to reinvent himself over this past month or so?
I wouldn't say he's managed to reinvent himself, but I think he's just continued to be the same Julius Malema, who has very good timing. And I think it's important to remember that Malema and his ilk are the people who, in the run-up to elections, go into the townships, rally. Julius Malema is responsible for President Zuma being in power, essentially. Julius Malema is responsible for the ANC having had a good result at the last municipal elections. And South Africa is run by politicians who are actually too scared to go into the townships, whereas Julius Malema and his boys go out there. So he knows how to work a crowd, and that's still working in his favour, and there's no one really to challenge him.
Alex Duval-Smith, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to be talking about Baghdad right after this.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bands.
You're cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we go to Zurich's International Radio Festival. We meet up with Damon Albarn's Africa Express and we have a lovely session and chat with ex-charlatan Tim Burgess.
Music tastes are very varied. I think if I can listen to them, then everyone else must be able to have that kind of broad sense of music as well. You know.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. One of the numerous consequences of the Arab uprisings, the US focus on Afghanistan and the ongoing tension between Israel and Iran, is that when it comes to the Middle East, Iraq, a country that has dominated headlines for much of the past decade, has found itself ignored by much of the rest of the world, making the briefest of appearances at the top of the news only when something catastrophic happens. Which is why we were talking about Iraq a week ago, when more than 100 people were killed in a seemingly coordinated wave of attacks across 13 cities, all on the same day that the country's fugitive vice president, Tariq al-Hashemi, was sentenced to death in absentia. Monocle contributor Barry Malone has been based in Baghdad for Reuters over the past few months. Now, on a well-deserved break back in the UK, he joins us here in the studio. Barry, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about what's happening right now in not just in Baghdad but across Iraq. As we're saying, it's a story that has drifted away from the headlines, and we only really seem to take much notice when something major happens. What's been going on in the past few weeks?
Yeah, as you said, it's that story that's gone away, but yet hasn't gone away at all. You know, it's like, you know, at the end of a film when you see the characters head off into the sunset and you wonder, well, what happened after they headed off into the sunset? Iraq reminds me of that, because for a lot of the international media, when the US troops left, that was it. The story was over. But yet still, the Iraqi people are suffering the consequences and living with the daily ramifications of the US invasion in 2003. So, as you say, the only time that we revisit the story really is when there's a major attack, you know, when there's 100 people maybe killed in a spectacular, which we had on the night of this month, just over a week ago. But really, the situation as it stands at the moment is that there are daily attacks. You know, there are daily bombings, there are daily shootings all over the country, not just in Baghdad. And what we've seen emerge is a sort of a pattern since the US troops left, which is that in the months after they've left, once a month, we'll have one spectacular attack in which usually around and about between sort of 60 to 100 people are killed. This last attack that we had just over a week ago, 115 people were killed by our tally, which would make it the bloodiest day of the year so far. So, you know, and then, as you say, you had that added complication of the vice president being sentenced to death. So the politics are also very, very interesting, very complex. And as you say, it's a story that's sort of slipped off the agenda.
And when we look at the attacks that are going on, how much of it is entirely sectarian, and how much of it is more simply about power?
Well, there's a complicated mix of groups who are involved in the violence there. You know, usually the group that's blamed is an Al-Qaeda offshoot, like an Al-Qaeda affiliate group that's based in Baghdad. It's called the Islamic State of Iraq. It seems that like they are behind the majority of the attacks. But then there are other Sunni Islamist groups who are also trying to destabilize the government. And even, would you believe, you know, here we are nearly 10 years later, there are still some groups who are aligned to Saddam Hussein, you know, former Saddam loyalists, former Baathists, who are trying to launch attacks to destabilize the government, to take credibility away from the government. The reason that they're launching the attacks is because the government is very delicately balanced. You know, you have a coalition government made up of, it's not a coalition, it's more of a power sharing arrangement. Mm. So you have a Shiite bloc, which essentially leads the government. You have a Sunni bloc, and you have a Kurdish bloc as well. And they haven't been able to agree on exactly how they're going to share power. And this sort of political crisis, you could call it, has dragged on for a year. And what these groups who launch the attacks daily are trying to do is they're trying to exploit that tension to try and drag Iraq back into the sectarian sort of bloodletting that you've seen in 2006, 2007, when tens and tens of thousands of people were killed.
And when we talk about the political differences between this power sharing government, I mean, it's not like elsewhere in the world where there's a minister might be sacked or there'll be some sort of background briefing. I mean, you know, the leader of the Sunni faction, if you like, within the government, the vice president Tariq al-Hashemi, has just been sentenced to death.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's they don't reshuffle. They don't brief against each other in the newspapers. Well, they do.
Yes.
But that's the least of your worries if you're an Iraqi politician. Yeah, absolutely. Tariq al-Hashemi has been sentenced to death. And also what he's been sentenced to death for is, you know, he's been convicted of running death squads.
Death squads, yeah.
Yeah, death squads, rather dramatic term. But he's been convicted of running death squads, Sunni death squads that targeted Shiite politicians, Shiite judges. So the accusation is that, you know, that he, his bodyguards, his own personal sort of, protection units went out there and killed prominent Shiites. So, absolutely. Even within the hierarchies of the political scene in Iraq, there can be accusations of fairly extreme violence, yeah.
Are there any bright spots when you look out across the whole country and you've reported from all over the place and you follow it very closely? Are there areas which are far calmer, where there haven't been attacks or where some sort of political progress seems to be being made?
There are. Probably the brightest spot is the Kurdistan region. You know, you'll remember that that the Kurds struck a deal after the US invasion, whereby the region in which they predominate, the north of the country, Kurdistan, became semi-autonomous. Most of the media now term it autonomous. You know, the central government, Baghdad, has very little control over that part of the country. And the Kurds have done a pretty good job. You know, they've started exploring for oil. They've discovered a lot of oil. They're exporting oil with the help of Baghdad. And they're taking 14% of the total oil revenues. And they seem to have been spared they've been spared that Sunni Shia bloodletting because, you know, they're a 100% Kurdish region. And, you know, as a sort of a test case for how Iraq could be calm, could be peaceful, could be successful, Kurdistan is pretty impressive. But, you know, it hinges on oil. And I think that if you're looking for the hope for Iraq, it's probably, you know, the oil revenues. A lot of people have said over the years that oil was the curse because, you know, people will theorize that that's why the West was so involved in Iraq, was because of its oil revenues. But now oil is the great hope, because with oil will hopefully come prosperity and will become influence, and, you know, Iraq can reestablish itself as a regional power.
And it already seems to be fueling something of a boom in Erbil, in Kurdistan.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you look at, you know, the houses that are being built, the industries that's being set up. You know, I was being told a story the other day about a yacht on a lake near Erbil, which suggests there's
people making money for sure.
Yes, yeah. There are people making money. Whether it all trickles down, in that horrible phrase, to the majority.
Well, and the Kurds are doing
issue.
Deals with foreign oil companies now. That's very important as well. You know, they've struck a deal with Chevron. They've struck a deal with Exxon. You've got Gazprom going in there. So, you know, they're big foreign companies who are willing to do business not just only through the central Baghdad government, but with the government in Erbil, which maybe will result in more yachts on the lake you talk about.
When Iraqis look at what's been happening with the Arab uprisings elsewhere within the region, is there a sense of, well, actually, we should be doing better here as well? Less, you know, we need our own revolution, but, you know, we feel that we can push now for more from our government.
Yeah, perhaps there have been some demonstrations in Baghdad, and. You've hit the nail on the head in that they've been slightly different from the demonstrations that you've seen in other parts of the region, where people are calling for a new government, where they're calling for a democracy. And in Iraq, they're calling for basic services. You know, so when the Arab Spring uprising started, Iraqis did go to, there's a Tahrir Square in Baghdad, you know, same as there's in Cairo. Yeah. And Iraqis were going down there and they were asking for, you know, electricity. They were asking for a refuse collection. They were asking for women's rights. Actually, like last week, I met some women's groups who had protested in the square wanting full equality for women. So,
and they can hold those protests?
They have been able to. You know, the police did crack down on some of the groups who were holding the protests. For example, the women's groups. One of the activists who I spoke to says that, you know, that she was arrested, that she was tortured, that she was told not to protest again. So, yeah, it's not easy. But I think the most interesting thing about it is that, like you say, the Iraqis looking for basic services are not looking to topple the government. They're tired of war. That's the last thing that Iraqis want. What they want is to be able to turn on a light switch and to have power. You know, what they want is to have their rubbish collected. What they want is for the country to normalize again, you know.
Indeed. Barry, stick with us. We're going to talk to you more in a little bit about what life is like for yourself and for others in Baghdad. You're listening to Midori House.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new programme on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
You're You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and I still have in the studio our Baghdad contributor, Barry Malone, who's also working for Reuters over in the Iraqi capital. Barry, let's talk a little bit about what it's like for you as a journalist in Baghdad covering this story on a daily basis. Let's start with the basics. Where do you live? What's your house like?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, yeah. I mean, you know that that there's the green zone.
Yeah.
Right. So in the centre of Baghdad, you have this very heavily fortified area where you've got the parliament, where you've got the prime minister's office, where you have all the foreign embassies, massive US embassy compound that's become very famous is there, you know, the British embassy, etc. We actually live outside of that place. We live in normal Baghdad. You know, if you speak to diplomats, they'll say, "Oh, you live in the red zone." Well, okay, no, I live in Baghdad.
Baghdad, yes.
You know, or I was speaking to one diplomat last week who said, "Oh, you don't live in the green zone. You live in the badlands." So you know, there's still that attitude, sadly, from a lot of the diplomatic community. Whereas, you know, it's actually we live in a neighborhood, a very functioning neighborhood in the city. Having said that, we are fairly well protected. Where we live is sort of a city block. We have armed guards around it. We have blast walls to protect ourselves from any, you know, suicide bombings or the like that might go off. And we have a house and we have an office on the same protected compound. And
so not much of a commute.
No, not much of a commute. You know, you can walk into the office in your boxer shorts. It's fine. But yeah. And you know, all of the media basically lived like that and lived very heavily protected. Moving around Baghdad has been very problematic over the last few years for foreign correspondents. So you would find that all of the big organizations, you know, Reuters, BBC, AP, New York Times, would move around in armored cars with foreign armed guards. You know, a correspondent traveling in one car and then a chase car behind in case anything happens. So, I mean, pretty serious.
And is it still like that at all for anyone, or is it?
Not so much. What we're finding now is that a lot of the big organizations are sort of easing back on that security a little bit. There hasn't been a high profile kidnapping of a foreigner for a good few years now. As I say, with the major attacks where, you know, maybe 100 people will be killed, we're looking at about once a month for those attacks. And really, it's very difficult to manage the risk away in that case. I mean, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you're going to fall victim to it. So, aside from that sort of once a month spectacular, people are moving around the city more and more, and Iraqis are moving around more and more. There's, you know, they're finding the confidence to sit out in cafes or, you know, to wander through a park. Actually, last week, I went for a walk through a park in the center of Baghdad. I walked down by the Tigris. I spoke to a few Iraqis. They offered me some shisha. Friendly, very welcoming. And
could you do that on your own, or did you have to have other Iraqis with you just in case?
I went with a security specialist just in case, and I went with an Iraqi who knew the area very well as well. But we were very low key. We walked through the area. People were incredibly welcoming. They wanted to talk to us about what was happening in Iraq. They wanted to talk about what was happening in the wider region, and they were very politically engaged. And like I say, key, they were sitting around with their children, drinking coffee, drinking tea, smoking shisha. There was picnics going on. You know, that is not something that would have happened a few years ago. So there is definitely a perception in Baghdad that security is becoming a little bit more predictable and things are becoming a little bit safer. And you're seeing the effects of that in the city centre in terms of how people are living their lives, which is very interesting.
Do you get the sense that, you know, in a year's time, you know, it'll be, is the aim that, you know, journalists will be able to move around a bit more freely, that other people within the city will be, I mean, does it all seem to be going in the right direction?
Yeah, from that point of view, it does. Obviously, what we talked about earlier, the sort of once a month attacks, obviously those groups would want to increase the frequency of those attacks. Those groups will want to undermine that security. If they succeed in that, that's the only threat that could turn things around. But at the moment, things seem to be on a positive trajectory in terms of the confidence that people have to start living a normal life again. And, you know, when you walk around Baghdad or when you talk to Iraqis, certainly that evening that I went out to the park and had a chat with people, you know, your vast majority of Iraqis, that's what they want. They just want a normal existence. You know, it's been 10 years of militarization and attacks and violence. And so they're making a real effort, you know, to normalize, to get businesses going, to open shops and cafes and even bars, you know, and or nightclubs. People want to socialize. They want to be out there. They want Baghdad to be a normal city again. The government is doing its bit too. They've been taken down, you know, you'll have seen on the news, you know, these blast walls that they throw up around important buildings. They've been taking them down. And they've been on some sort of boulevards. They've been planting flowers, and they've been painting the sidewalks, and all of those things I think are important because they give the appearance of a normal city, and they give people that confidence to go out there again. And yeah, as a journalist, that's certainly what we want, because you know we can report a lot more effectively if we can get out and move around more freely and talk to people. And up until this point, we've largely relied on the very brilliant Iraqi correspondents who work for us. But it'd be nice as a foreigner to be able to get out and about as well.
Barry Malone from Reuters, from Baghdad, here in London, with us today. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to Midori House. The news is after this.
This is Monocle 24.
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 Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be continuing our Lusophone series, and we'll also be having a guest from the London Design Festival. But first, here's James with the headlines.
NATO has ordered a cutback on operations with Afghan forces in response to a surge of so-called insider attacks on foreign servicemen. However, the peacekeepers' strategy in Afghanistan remains unchanged, according to its chief, Aneshvar Rasmussen. In other developments, Afghan militants have claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb attack on a minibus carrying foreign workers that killed at least 12 people near Kabul. Afghan police said among the dead were 8 Russians and South Africans, mostly working for a foreign air charter company. 2 unarmed policewomen have been killed in a shooting in the north of England. The attack in a district of Manchester is likely to reignite a long-running debate in Britain over whether officers should carry guns. And Britain's cash-strapped government is considering further cuts to its welfare bill, according to media reports, with a coalition source confirming an idea to scrap the link between inflation and rises in benefit payments. Greece will meet its nominal 2012 deficit reduction targets, but faces growing strain because of the deepening recession, according to its finance minister. His announcement came as pressure grew on international creditors to give the Greek government more time to catch up. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. You're listening to Midori House.
The Venice Architecture Biennale is a heady place to take the temperature of the industry and a good place to forecast its future. Monocle Films was there to do both.
As the industry flocked to Venice for the 13th Architecture Biennale, it was greeted by a storm of biblical proportions, which rolled into the lagoon out of nowhere. Even the greatest cynic pondered if this might be punishment for previous gaudy, expensive, ego-driven projects. But even these clouds had silver linings. As they tumbled away, they revealed a Venice that looked better than ever.
Architecture on film, in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. And as you know, we're coming to you live from London, where the 10th London Design Festival is well underway. Now, each day this week on Midori House, we'll be speaking to a different key player in the festival. And today it's the turn of Jason Bruges, who founded his eponymous studio in 2001. Jason does more than make chairs and tables. He's an interaction designer and has worked for an intriguing list of clients, ranging from a children's hospice in Kuwait to the Olympic Park here in London. Tomorrow, he'll be chairing an event hosted by Arup called Design You Can't See, But Can Feel, Perceive and Interact With. and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much.
Let's start at the beginning. What exactly is an interaction designer?
Right. Interaction designer is a term that was probably coined about 20 years ago to describe a set of designers that look at essentially interactions between humans and devices, primarily in the first instance computers and screens and websites and kiosks. But in the example of my studio, Jason Bruce Studio, we've actually taken that one step further, and it's how we interact with our environment. So,
and how did you come to be an interaction designer yourself?
I trained as an architect in the two phases that entails. And in my postgraduate phase at UCL, I started looking at how buildings could interact with us. So the interaction design was actually through an architectural kind of thread.
Most people would assume that, you know, design's about furniture or it's about objects. Do you get the sense there's this growing appreciation of design, its potential to affect, you know, all walks of life?
Well, I think you step back and you think about, you look at this sort of world around you of furniture and walls and floors and windows and vehicles, and what if there's another layer that can talk to you, perform to you, have a conversation with you? And I think that starts to get very, very exciting, and I think we're already starting to see what the potential for that is.
And for something like the London Design Festival, which is, you know, it's obviously bringing all sorts of people to the city from all over the world. I mean, how important do you think events like this are for helping people understand, you know, what design is and what it can be?
The Penguin Pool event at Arups is, I think it's an event, like many of the others, through the week to encourage debate and bring like-minded people together, albeit from potentially very different disciplines. Mm. And as a lead speaker at the event, we've got a panel which ranges from kind of engineers and artist collectives. And it's going to be really interesting to see what different takes on interaction are, because it does actually change depending what industry you're from.
Well, indeed. I mean, let's talk about that talk. Design You Can't See is the title, which perhaps makes it perfect for radio. Can you talk us through, you know, the sorts of things that are going to be discussed?
Well, I think, funnily enough, I think Arups, when they sort of originally created the talk, thought that this was a sort of special area. But the more we've talked about design you can't see, it means many things to many different people. I mean, essentially, obviously, it's something literally that's hidden. Mm. It's an invisible process of interaction between a person and a piece of design. And it's really thinking about that kind of complete choreography of how you actually work with something. And then secondly, it might be about a process we call in the studio visualizing the invisible. So it's a sort of empathetics at a kind of built environment level, looking at kind of invisible things you don't otherwise see.
When you look at the festival as a whole, I mean, it's billing London as the creative capital of the world. And yeah, London likes to see itself always as mm-hmm. the centre of the world, whether it's in sport or fashion or design or whatever. Do you think that, you know, based on your experience and, you know, where you've worked elsewhere, that London can really say, oh, yes, no, we're definitely the creative capital of the world when it comes to design?
I think start off this kind of thread within the design world, you need a lot of creators coming together, which will spark off these unusual combinations. And I mean, in our studio, we have architects and artists and interaction designers. And it's sometimes these conversations will happen within hybrid collectives or different people coming together. So I think London is a perfect place for that to happen. And without that mix, I don't think it would take place in many other places, which it doesn't.
Jason Bruges of Jason Bruges Studio, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. He is chairing an event hosted by Arup tomorrow called Design You Can't See But Can Feel, Perceive and Interact With. Best of luck with that, Jason. Tomorrow on Midori House, we'll be talking to Martin Roth, director of the V&A, about the institution's involvement in the London Design Festival. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at the changing economic climate in Brazil.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favourite objects is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s, and I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, as you may have noticed, all this week, there's a distinctly Lusophone flavour to Monocle 24. That is to say, Portuguese speaking to the uninitiated. Although by the end of this week, you'll know all these phrases, don't you worry. The current issue of Monocle, which is about to hit newsstands, I think on Thursday, although of course if you're a subscriber, you'll be thumbing through already, looks at the common ground shared by the eight countries across four continents that make up the Lusophone community. And today we decide to check in with someone at the heart of the current Brazilian boom, John Ferreira, CEO of Now Securities, a strategic advisor specialising in the Brazilian retail market. John, welcome to Midori House. Now, I wonder if you could start by giving us a bit of an overview of the luxury retail sector in Brazil.
It's relatively small, but growing at a rapid pace. And what's driving that growth are quite strong forces in that the country benefits from enormous mineral resource and also agriculture and food resources. That's leading to growth in real incomes over the last few years. And ultimately, the number of potential consumers of luxury goods has expanded at a very rapid rate.
Now, obviously, this is something that, you know, all of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, have experienced to a certain extent. But it seems to have taken hold a little bit more in Brazil. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's kind of partly historic in that for various reasons, reasons including structural reasons, there wasn't much supply. But what you've seen in recent years is a fast development of the shopping mall industry and general retail industry, and essentially catering for what was pent-up demand. So you've had a combination of dramatically rising real incomes, a significant movement of people into the middle, but also the affluent and upper class social classes of Brazil, and high growth in the supply of options for those consumers.
Now, in the new issue of Monocle, we've got a piece by our old business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, who headed to Sao Paulo to look at the newest shopping malls that are being built there, including one enormous one by Iguatemi. What is it about Iguatemi that has made it possible for them to take off in the way that they have?
Well, Iguatemi, of all the players in the shopping mall industry in Brazil, they very much focus on the high level. And they've also, I think, not just attracted international brands to their shopping malls, but also they've also focused on the specific needs of the Brazilian consumer in terms of the care the consumer gets when they arrive there, the options that they have available to them. So they've really positioned themselves very smartly, I think, especially in the key areas, which are clearly São Paulo and Rio.
And how sustainable is this? I mean, when we look at the Brazilian economy at the moment, it's going through a bit of a slowdown. There are some concerns about whether it can maintain the rapid growth it experienced over the past few years. Do you still expect to see more numbers joining this emerging middle class?
Well, I think have to look at the forces that are at play here. Brazil isn't going to grow in a straight line. It never has done. And as we've seen in other parts of the world, that's actually been quite hard to achieve. But what Brazil does have, and I think is a fact, is it has enormous wealth when it comes to agricultural products and food products. It's top three producer in main food items in the world already and has tremendous scope to grow even from that point. Also, it's now discovered a third of the world's offshore oil in the last 5 years, so it's going to become one of the world's big oil exporters, and on top of that, it has mineral wealth, so it's one of the largest producers of iron ore, for example. So all those things are very significant and place Brazil in a unique position in many ways in the global economy and what's happening in the world right now. So with that background, as long as the government follows policies which are sensible, which I think they have done in recent years, that bodes well for employment and real income growth, as we've seen in recent years. Now, of course, there will be challenges. There were challenges in 2009, and there's certainly challenges right now, given what's happening in the world. But the government have acted quickly. They've drastically reduced the interest rates. They were 13.5% or so a year ago. They're down to 7.5%. And they've introduced a whole range of measures to essentially stimulate growth and keep the economy ticking away. So although growth is expected to come off quite a bit this year, possibly to 1.5-2% this year, the central bank and I think most external commentators are really looking at 3.5-4.5% growth as a sustainable level of growth for Brazil going forward.
And just finally, John, I mean, when we look at the cities where they're experiencing this boom, where the luxury retail sector is really taking off, it's the obvious ones like Sao Paulo and Rio, but I wonder, are you seeing similar sorts of increases in these sectors in other places like Belo Horizonte or Santos or other Brazilian cities?
Well, yes. I mean, the bulk of the economic activity of the country, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, is in the south and southeast and around Sao Paulo and Rio. But certainly there are other parts of Brazil which are experiencing tremendous growth for various reasons. It may be because they're a centre of a particular agricultural product or are benefiting from the oil and gas exploration that's currently taking place. So for example, in the northeast, you're seeing much higher growth than you're seeing in the rest of the country. More industries moving in that direction, and people are understanding that there are retail and commercial opportunities with a demographic in that part of Brazil. So, and other, as you mentioned, other cities are also now attracting increasing interest from retailers and other activities to cater to that growth.
John Ferreira, CEO of Now Securities, thank you very much for joining us. And now, because we've just been talking about Brazil, we'll have some music from Brazil. This is a pick from our Brazilian researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. So it's his fault, not mine. No. Let's put it the other way. He can take the credit, not me. This is Gabi Amarantos. Ended abruptly, but lovely, wasn't it? That was Ela Tá Bêbada Doida by Gabi Amarantos, who I'm fairly sure is going to become a regular addition to the Monocle 24 playlist. You're listening to Midori House. We're heading to Istanbul right after this.
On the latest edition of Section D, we check out the pocket-sized craft trade fair in Tokyo for stockists. We find out who might be getting their hands on Usain Bolt's bed and what will happen to the rest of the furniture from the Olympic Village. And we visit a pioneering design studio in Ramallah, turning trash into treasure.
When it comes to trash that we know already is a huge problem, that's what we start out by designing, and then we finding the raw material has been the easiest part.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 2052 in Helsinki, 1952 in Cairo, 1852 right here in London. Since the days it was known as Constantinople, Istanbul has always liked to see itself as a gateway to Asia, an economic and political powerhouse that has influence in Europe and across the Middle East. In recent years, the combination of an ambitious foreign policy and economic growth that has far outpaced its neighbours on both sides of the Bosphorus has helped revive memories of past glories. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan's next move is the Istanbul International Financial Centre, something which Bloomberg describes as an upstart Wall Street on the Sea of Marmara. To discuss whether this is just a pipe dream or a realistic ambition, I'm joined now by Taylan Bilgic, former managing editor at Hurriyet Daily News and a financial journalist based in Istanbul. Taylan, thank you very much for joining us. Good evening. Is this going to happen, or is this just one of Erdogan's grand plans?
Well, that's a good question. And the bets are off there, actually. On a strictly property basis, the project seems feasible, but it's an open question whether building high-rise towers would make a city a global or regional financial center. So there is, of course, a possibility that this is only another grand project of the government, and there have been other projects which still remain on paper, like Mr. Erdogan's crazy project that was going to open another channel into Istanbul. So it's an open-ended question at the moment.
What's wrong with the stock exchange current building? I mean, it's not that bad, is it?
It's great. It's great. But the idea here is that you've got this huge district on the Asian side of the city, and on the one hand, finance towers from the European side will move to that district, and on the other hand, huge financial institutions from Ankara, the capital, will move there. So in a way, it will be a meeting place for Ankara bureaucracy and Istanbul finance.
Sounds delightful, Ankara bureaucracy coming to Istanbul. Now, aside from perhaps slimlining things in Turkey itself, this is also a little bit about countering the possible threat from Dubai and other growing financial centres in the Middle East. Do you think that if this were to go ahead, it would be something that a Dubai, for example, may be a little bit worried about?
At the moment, I do not think so, because we still haven't seen a plan in action. We still have blueprints. And mind you, there's still a bit of a domestic resistance to the plan. For example, opposition parties have frequently voiced concerns that the IFC project is a thinly veiled project to diminish the importance of Ankara as the nation's capital, and make Istanbul as a de facto capital of a neo-Ottoman empire. So there's all kinds of political debates going on in Turkey about this. And as I said, regarding property, building high-rise sky towers, carrying state banks and the central bank and banking regulators from Ankara to Istanbul are all fine, but all that do not make Istanbul a financial center.
Mm. Let's talk about those that sort of dispute, as it is, between Istanbul and Ankara. I mean, it's noticeable that when you go to Ankara and you talk to people that live there that are there for government reasons, none of them really want to be there, do they? I mean, you even have quite a lot of sort of senior officials within the government who live in Istanbul and commute to Ankara. Do you get the sense that there is a sort of a desire within some government figures to shift the seat of government to the north?
I don't think that will happen as a practical step, but On the ground, it seems that the importance of Ankara is diminishing. And it's not only about finance and economy. For example, foreign commentators have probably noticed that diplomacy has also been moving to Istanbul with all these international meetings, events happening in Istanbul. And you see, when you add the movement of regulators and bureaucracy from Ankara to Istanbul, I see some truth in...
And the weather's the better in Istanbul as well, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's, of course. I've been in Ankara, I've been in Istanbul, and I definitely prefer Istanbul as a city. But for a huge portion of the Turkish population, Ankara is some sort of a heritage from Atatürk, because it was built from scratch as the capital of a new nation.
Indeed, indeed. Taylan Bilgiç, former Magyar at Hürriyet Daily News and a financial journalist based in Istanbul. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. And that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to our producer, Paul Noble, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who also chose the music, and our studio managers, Toby Hammond and Will Kisby. Up after the news is this week's episode of Section D with Hugh MacDonald. And 3 hours after that, 2200 hours here in London, Tom Burgess Watson and Tamsin Smith will be back for the Monocle Daily. Hugo is a busy boy. He's going to be back here tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. That's 1800 hours London time. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield, thanks for listening. Goodbye.